Hello?
Hello, Sydney. Remember me?
No. This is Kurt Anderson. What do you need?
I want you. It's showtime.
Today in Studio 360, we kick off our latest listener challenge. We want you to make a super short, super scary film or video. And we've got the master of horror, Wes Craven, here to judge the entry.
When you sit down to think of somebody scary, you can just think of somebody from when you were in sixth grade getting beat up all the time. That's how Freddy got invented, really.
Plus, we'll hear about a Black Panther funk band that tried to jam its way to revolution.
If you weren't going to come to a rally and listen to a speech, then I'll sing it to you. How's that?
That and much more is ahead in this hour of Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
In 1953, I was asked to sing at Oberlin College. A small group of students said, we've got the basement of the art school. It'll hold 200 people, and I think if we pass the hat, we'll make your bus fare. So I took a bus to Cleveland. They picked me up. And sure enough, I made my bus fare. A year later, I went out to Oberlin and sang in the chapel for 500 people. Now I got more money, too. I could afford to fly out there. And the next year, I went out to Oberlin and sang for 1,000 people in their big auditorium. And now I was going from college to college to college. It was the most important work I ever did in my life.
I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360. 4 years ago, I went to visit Pete Seeger, who died this week, at his home in upstate New York. He lived in a house that he built himself years ago in the woods on the Hudson River.
You know what I need to do is put on my hearing aid.
Okay.
It's in the other room.
All righty. I'd gone to talk with him about This Land Is Your Land. The song was written by his friend Woody Guthrie, but it was Seeger who made it one of the most well-known modern American songs of all. Blacklisted as a commie during the 1950s, Seeger went from college to college, singing and playing, about to catch the 60s wave.
In the 1960s, the most talented singers and songwriters came along, not just Bob Dylan and Phil Oakes, Buffy St. Marie and Joni Mitchell, people that are part of history now. And they went from college to college.
Do you feel as though they were your children a bit?
I look upon this whole country, I've got not hundreds, but thousands, maybe tens of thousands of grandchildren and great-grandchildren, people who got the idea, hey, you can say something with a song instead of a speech. And if it's a good song, other people will pick it up and sing it.
25 or 30 years before dropping out of college to rebel against the man was even a thing, Seeger had done it.
The reason I left Harvard in my second year was because I felt that professors could be just as selfish and foolish as anybody else. I remember one of them insisted that we must use his definition of words like ideational. And once he tried to persuade the whole class, don't waste your time trying to save the world. What you must do is study it. You cannot save the world. All you can do is study.
Which is quite a thing to say in 1937, 38.
Exactly. There was Hitler coming along, and some of us were trying to figure out how to stop him.
Singing at Obama's inauguration a year ago. How did that come about?
Mainly an extraordinary, wonderful, honest man named Bruce Springsteen.
Bruce Springsteen invited you down there to be part of that?
He arranged the whole thing, and it was so well organized, it was unbelievable. A large cast of several hundreds. There were teenagers from Washington who memorized the choruses and joined in on them. And all I had to do was give the lines to the audience. I shouted, as I was walking that ribbon of highway. And now the audience sings, as I was walking that ribbon of highway. Saw above me. The audience sang the whole song. Biggest audience I ever had in my life, like a million people stretching out from Lincoln Memorial all the way to the Washington Monument.
I spoke with Pete Seeger a few winters ago for our American Icon story, This Land Is Your Land. He died this week, age 94. You can see a video of some of our conversation with his great view of the Hudson River in the background at studio360.org.
And so we keep on while we live until we have no more to give. And when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old banjo to young ones stronger, and when these fingers can strum no longer, and the old banjo to young ones stronger. Before the dawn, this thought keeps us moving on through all this world of joy and sorrow. We still can have singing tomorrows through all this world. Sing it with me, of joy and sorrow. We still can have singing tomorrows through all this world of joy and sorrow. We still can have singing tomorrow.
Thanks to Pike Malinowski, who recorded and produced that original interview. Coming up, another angrier generation of American lefties finds a way to spread the message in song.
People would sing along with us and all that, and it was something that lifted people's spirit and made the work easier.
From Watts to Brownsville. R&B Black Panther style. And we'll kick off our latest listener challenge with director Wes Craven. That is all ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. What's your favorite scary movie? There's a decent chance that Wes Craven made it or dreamed it up or influenced whoever did. He wrote and directed Last House on the Left, The Hills Have Eyes, Nightmare on Elm Street, and when Craven got tired of all the horror film tropes he'd helped invent, he started deconstructing them in the Scream movies.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Oh, come on, you know I don't watch the dish.
Why not? Too scared?
No, it's just, what's the point? They're all the same. Some stupid killer stalking some big-breasted girl who can't act, who's always running up the stairs when she should be going out the front door. It's insulting.
Now, Wes Craven wants you to become a scary movie auteur. It's the latest of our extra credit projects that we're calling Wes Craven Presents Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest. It's hashtag Scary Shorts. Wes Craven, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks.
And thank you so much for agreeing to judge our latest extra credit listener challenge.
It sounds really frightening.
Oh, good. Well, that's the intention. I'm wondering, though, first, if we can talk about your life and career. When was it that you realized you had a knack for depicting suspense of a violent particular kind?
After I made my first film.
Really?
Yeah. I was just basically learning the very rudiments of making film. I hadn't studied film or anything, but I had impulsively quit my college teaching job and come to New York. And I had met a guy who had made a small film that I ended up working on. And at the end of that film, the backers, who were a bunch of guys in Boston that owned outdoor theaters, told him we need a scary movie. So he came to me, said, Wes, these guys want a scary film. Can you write something scary? I said, I've never even seen a scary movie. And he knew that I had been raised as a fundamentalist Baptist. And he said, you were raised that way, right? And I said, yeah. He said, well, just drag all the skeletons out of your closet. So I went and wrote a script, Last House on the Left. They liked it, and we made it. And I was a horror filmmaker.
Here is the first motion picture to offer to the daring a look into the final maddening space between life and death. The Last House on the Left. To avoid fainting, keep repeating.
It's only a movie. Only a movie.
Those voices were my family, actually.
Really?
No, not really.
That was your father. You'd recorded him when you were very young. So why were you able to knock it out of the park the first time?
You know, I don't know. That's the honest answer. I mean, you know, I was born the month Hitler invaded Poland, so there was the world was at war for my first 5 years. I had a father that was kind of scary that died when I was quite young, so I was introduced to disappearance of a parent and death. And I was, you know, a quiet kid in school. I was the one that got chased around by the bully. So the way people look at people who make scary films is kind of backwards. You know, it logically you would think, oh, they must be scary themselves. But a lot of them grew up being the kid who was scared of the bullies and the crazies and getting beat up. So you
– That pretty much means all artists. But
yeah. Well, it does. And it you know, when you sit down to think of somebody scary, you can just think of somebody from when you were in sixth grade getting beat up all the time. That's how Freddy got invented, really.
And do you feel like you got better at it over the years of filmmaking and making these kinds of films in particular?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. You know, it was always a matter of, with the Nightmare series, I did two that I actually wrote and directed. It was always trying to go up to the next level to figure out. I think the last one I did was discovering kind of the meta level of having people that made the original film actually be the characters in the last film. And then was fortunate enough to get the script offered to me for Scream.
Which is meta in an entirely different
way.
Totally
meta, yeah. And, you know, kind of just breaking the walls down and going into areas that were interesting, but even more about the culture and the culture's sort of love affair with media.
So many of your films deal with sinners being punished. And does that, as I'm sensing it does, come from this fundamentalist background? You went to a Christian college?
It was more like religion might not protect you as much as you think it does. And that the thing that really will endanger you more than anything else is falling asleep. And I meant that in the sense of not being awake to what is a clear and present danger to you in the most real sense, and not going into denial.
Speaking of religion, I read that you, along with Lee Daniels and Gus Van Sant and some other directors, are going to be each directing 1/10 of a miniseries about the Ten Commandments.
Yes, it just came from meetings on that today, meeting the producers and so forth.
What's your commandment?
Yes. Thou shalt not kill.
Well, there you go. You get the prime one.
Yeah, but it's not a slasher thing. It's not anything like that.
Really?
It's actually about a
– And not set in biblical times?
No, they're all set in contemporary times.
Huh.
So it's about a drone pilot actually and his family and the effect that is having on him and on his family and especially on his son.
So entirely outside the Wes Craven genre.
Yes and no. I mean, you know, if you
– Unless the drone comes back and chases him around America.
Well, the majority of my films actually are about families. You know, if you think about it,
sure.
Nightmare on Elm Street, Dead and Blessing, they're all actually – even Scream is deeply embedded in the families of Sydney and Billy. So,
well, let's introduce this contest we've shanghaied you into. We are calling it Wes Craven Presents Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest.
Hello.
Wes Craven Presents.
Welcome to my nightmare.
Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest.
You guys see my shorts?
I'd love to. I thought it was kind of scary.
We want people to use Vine or Instagram or any kind of device to make very, very short scary films, no more than 30 seconds long, and then share them with us online. And you, Wes Craven, are going to pick the best one. What about that challenge of trying to be suspenseful and generate fear in 30 seconds? That's a tough one.
Well, I think, you know, today is the attention span of most kids is about, 5 seconds. So,
oh, that's a long film.
I think to keep them there for 10 seconds is going to be tough.
Oh, there you go. There are rules, of course, to the genre, and I want to play a clip from your film Scream, the original from 1996, about some of those rules.
For instance, number one, you can never have sex. Big no-no! Big no! Sex equals death, okay? Number two, you can never drink or do drugs. No, the sin factor. It's a sin. It's an extension of number one. And number three, never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
I'm getting another beer. You want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
Should our contest, apart from the length, have any rules? Should we thought about making everybody put some certain prop in each of the films or have some certain bit of dialogue, or should we just let them do whatever they can?
Yeah, you know, actually I worked on the Project Greenlight, one of their sessions of it, and we had a rule that they had to use a certain phrase. And what we found was, because we followed that through, that there would be some moment in all of these short films where somebody just said something that made absolutely no sense whatsoever. So I didn't want to impose that on somebody that had so little time to do what they were going to do. I think it'd be better to just say the single continuing thing that plays through all of them is young genius.
Young genius.
Yes.
There you go. Are there obvious things that people think is a way to scare people but isn't such a good thing, or rules that they can follow, or advice?
You know, I think that if the rules are known to the audience, then they're no longer scary. One of the key things about that speech in Scream, for instance, is all those rules were being broken by the movie as it happened.
Even in that scene.
They do not have sex, and the lead, Neve Campbell's character was upstairs having sex for the first time with her boyfriend, and she survived very well. And the guy who says, I'll be right back, was one of the killers, so he wasn't going to end up dead. So
I guess surprise.
It's breaking. Yeah. It's basically saying to the audience, okay, I know you think you know the rules, but now we're going to break them all in the course of this movie, so you're not going to know what's up. And I think that is, I don't want to get anything too heavy, but in our recent history in the United States, the worst things that have happened to him were somebody broke every rule imaginable. And that is what is really terrifying, when you think people will do things that you never conceived that they could do.
Well said. And we look forward to having Wes Craven back to talk about the submissions. Thank you very much, sir.
It's my pleasure.
You heard it, folks. Wes Craven wants to see your super short, super scary films. You can make it using Vine or Instagram, your digital camera, Super 8, VHS, whatever. But it's got to be less than 30 seconds long. Your theme is Young Genius. We've got all the details on how to enter at studio360.org. Your deadline is Oscar night, March 2nd at midnight.
Hashtag scary shorts.
And I'm very happy to be able to talk to you today.
10 years ago, a grad student named Ricky Vincent was digging into the archives at Stanford University, researching Huey Newton, the co-founder of the Black Panthers.
Because we must always realize that the people have the power, and without that knowledge...
While he was combing through Newton's papers, Vincent found a tape.
You'll never give up.
It didn't sound like much.
It was in two chunks, and one of the songs was cut in half, and I couldn't tell if it was the tape that was cut or, you know, if that song could be recovered or not.
But for a musicologist like Ricky, it was gold. He'd come here chasing a rumor, and the tape was proof.
We're tired of suffering, but not afraid of dying, of all we.
I learned about the lumpen from a conversation with Boots Riley, the lead rapper of The Coup, and he told me he heard somewhere that somebody said the Black Panthers had a band.
Nishat Kurwa has the remarkable story of the band called The Lumpen. Quick heads up, one of the band members uses some harsh racial language.
All power to the people!
The Lumpen got its name from Karl Marx,
Marx called society's most excluded people the Lumpin' Proletariat. That's gotta be the least funky name of a band ever. But the Lumpin' weren't really about being funky. They were about revolution, ending the oppression of black people once and for all. They met while bundling Black Panther Party newspapers late at night and singing to pass the time.
How to be free.
It's what black folks do. Michael and Santa Rita and I all knew each other. So while we're working, we're singing.
That's Bill Calhoun.
People would sing along with us and all that, and it was something that lifted people's spirit and made the work easier.
We're closing the door. There won't be no more.
Won't be no more.
There won't be no more. Won't
be no in the spring of 1970, the party's Minister of Culture, Emery Douglas, asked them to sing at a community rally. It went over well. Douglas convinced the party to take a chance at fronting a Black Panther singing group, complete with dance routines and costumes. Bill Calhoun recruited the band. He had been performing for years, gigging up and down California as Billy King. He had a regular show at a club in San Francisco when the Watts riot broke out, along with smaller uprisings in the Bay Area.
Earl Molotov cocktails, hot shots, and then barrages of gunfire.
The reaction of the club owner when he started talking about them niggers, it hit me that, yes, I am Billy King, and yes, I am the lead vocalist in the show, and yes, I am the MC, but I'm also one of them niggers. And that kind of changed things for me.
So you got to Oakland, and what was that like? There are all of these young people full of this revolutionary spirit, and...
You're a sweet girl.
You're so naive.
First of all, there was not a whole lot of people around with a lot of revolutionary zeal. During the entire civil rights episode, there probably was never more than 10% of the black population involved in any of it at any given time.
Now, the Panthers in 1970 were the epitome of radical chic. But getting recruits wasn't easy. Being in the party was kind of like college. The hard part, not the sex and drugs part.
In order to be a Panther, you had to, they had with a 12-page reading list for non and all these things. So that took all of the fanfare out of it.
This is one of the Lumpin' guys, Clark Bailey.
We enjoyed each other and we did what young men do, you know. But in terms of our direction, we never lost our direction.
There was a lot of socially conscious soul music in that era, like Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud. But the stars didn't get involved in radical politics.
I, Richard Bill House Nixon, do solemnly swear.
James Brown even performed at Richard Nixon's inaugural ball. Marxist funk was a whole new ballgame.
Instead of saying dance to the music with power to the people.
That's band member James Mott. They had some original songs, but they would also take hits and just rewrite the lyrics.
Remember, we didn't have a lot of time to rehearse. We had to load up, unload our equipment, set it up, get dressed. I remember Pat Hillier, David Hillier's wife, made our first outfits. We had a jumpsuit and the blue shirts. They were pretty cool.
All right, on the one hand, we were catching on. People wanted to see us. Okay, we didn't have a 45-minute set of original tunes. Yeah, I wasn't able to write fast enough to keep up with the demand.
Sometimes they'd leave a show at midnight and be serving grits to children at 6 a.m. Finally, they went into a recording studio and made their one and only record, Free Bobby. In 1969, the party's co-founder, Bobby Seale, had been sentenced to 4 years in prison for contempt of court.
He's proven his love for his people. That's why Bobby must be set free. We're saying Bobby must be set free.
No, it wasn't the fact that we put out a single and everybody went, "Wow, Bobby must be set free, yes!" No. I served pancakes, I sold papers, I did all kinds of things in the party, but that was our little singular contribution. If you weren't going to come to a rally and listen to a speech, then I'll sing it to you. How's that? Get the message, that's the point. Bobby must be set free. Huey must get out of jail.
In the winter of 1970, the Lumpin' went on tour, traveling to black colleges around the country. They played for a crowd of 15,000 at the Panthers Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. The night before they left home, they played at Merritt College in Oakland. They did their take on Curtis Mayfield's People Get Ready.
on this particular song.
This was the homemade tape Ricky Vincent found in the archives.
We dedicate to Jonathan Jackson, to William Christmas, to James McLean.
They have an interlude where they acknowledged all these Panthers that were killed by law enforcement, using the song as an opportunity to kind of respect the people in this struggle.
To all revolutionaries that have given their lives in the cause of freedom throughout the world, we the Lumpen respectfully dedicate this song.
It was more of a metaphor for the movement, the freedom train, and the Lumpen flipped it around and said, people get ready, the revolution's coming. You don't need a ticket, you need a loaded gun. Revolutionary artists can initiate radical change. The people that they reached, the people that heard their record, they got a hint of that. But the crises that faced the party were so severe, they didn't have a chance to really bring that whole movement into fruition.
By the time the Lumpen went on tour, the Black Panther Party had already begun to splinter. Party members were on trial, the FBI was raiding. More and more of the Panthers' time went to providing security. And then it was over.
I met a woman in the party that I had felt very deeply about. She became pregnant. She left. I was very concerned about that.
Bill Calhoun.
I was on security at National Headquarters. Within 10 minutes, the place is filled with FBI agents, and they're prepared to raid. And I was sitting there with my piece of technical equipment in my hand, and I was thinking about my pregnant girlfriend. And suddenly, that was the first time in my life this didn't seem quite as important. I woke up one morning, and a little voice in my head said, get up and leave now. Can you turn that off for just a second?
Of course.
This is awkward stuff for a former Panther to talk about. When I turned the recorder off, he told me more about how uneasy he'd become. The atmosphere of suspicion and distrust inside the party. Emory Douglas touched on it too, vaguely.
What people bring to the table when they come into the organization, whether they're in the rank and file or in a position of influence in the party, all those things still play into how people relate to each other. Human nature, yeah. And overcoming those obstacles, and yeah.
Even if they didn't achieve what they'd hoped, Ricky Vincent still finds the Lumpen inspiring. He wrote a book called Party Music about the band. And he thinks it might have gone very differently if they had been able to record an album.
Their work would have been treated as sort of a underground cult act like the Last Poets were.
The Last Poets are kind of like the godfathers of hip-hop.
These people did not get radio airplay, but they sold pretty well, and they sort of helped create a discourse. And so the Lumpen would have done that, but they would have thrown out a signal to the soul music industry that, look, you're on watch here. You can play your bubblegum pop, but there's another level here to what the people are ready for.
Because when the 60s were over, pop music put the revolution behind it.
I never will forget Paul McCartney. I can't believe I'm singing another silly love song. I mean, because things had just, the culture had shifted, and we were back to, let's get it on, instead of something that was important.
From Watts to Brownsville, we find misery.
But there won't be no more.
Won't be no more.
For Studio 360, I'm Nishad Kurwa.
Cause we've seen
how to be free.
How to be free.
From pigs.
Yes.
On the streets.
You can hear the Lumpen's Black Panther anthem, Free Bobby, at studio360.org.
We're closing the door.
And still ahead today in Studio 360, a filmmaker whose movies are really, truly like no others, starting with Koyaanisqatsi 30 years ago.
These are films that don't come out of the industry. They're like a cat that barks. They're unusual.
I'll talk with Godfrey Reggio about his brand new barking cat. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In the early 1980s, when independent film was just getting off the ground, a lot of people, me included, had their heads turned by a movie that was really unlike anything we'd seen in theaters before. There was no dialogue, no actors, no action or story in the normal sense. There were endless striking images, desert canyons, traffic zooming at night, a nuclear test. And there was a pulsing score by a composer who wasn't yet a household name, Philip Glass. It was called Koyaanisqatsi. The director, Godfrey Reggio, was a first-time filmmaker in his 40s, a guy who'd spent his life up to then as a monk and a social worker. Reggio has made only a few more films since and has just released his new one, Visitors. Like Koyaanisqatsi and its sequels, it is completely wordless and has a score by Philip Glass. Unlike them, Visitors is black and white, and it's made with really long shots, longer than anything you'll ever see in a movie theater. He joins me now, Godfrey Reggio. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
So given the stature of your movies and the influence of the Katsi trilogy, you personally have kept a low profile. Your name doesn't ring many bells, really, even among people who know and admire your work. Has that been a deliberate thing?
Well, I doubt if it's deliberate. I guess it's more to do with the nature of the films. These are films that don't come out of the industry. They're like a cat that barks. They're unusual. The names of the films are off the wall. And I think most people know the films by the name of Koyaanisqatsi.
Yes.
I think that's probably the best name.
And that's okay by you?
It's perfectly fine by me.
The word Koyaanisqatsi is from the Hopi Indian language, meaning life out of balance. With that film and those films, you had a clear point to make, despite the utter lack of narration or any didactic aspects. That was the premise with which you began?
Yes. First of all, the reason that there's no language in the film, which has to do with the clarity of being didactic or not, is not for lack of love of the language. It's because I feel our language no longer describes the world in which we live. To me, that is tragic because we see the world through our language. And if our language no longer describes that world, then what are we going to do? So what I've done is taken the Napoleonic dictum that a picture's worth a thousand words, turn it on its head, and offer you a thousand pictures to give you the power of one word.
I get that.
I do feel the film, its complete focus is on technology. But for me, technology is probably the most misunderstood subject on the planet. It's not about the effect of technology on our society, which would be environmental concerns. It's more about how technology has become the new host and comprehensive environment of life itself.
Your new film, Visitors, strikes me very differently, however. There is no real clear social ethical takeaway in the same way, is there?
It's different. You know, when you make a film, you don't want to repeat yourself. So I did the Katsi films, and it was over 30-something years to do that. In this film, the viewer herself, himself, is the subject of the film. The viewer is the storyteller. The viewer is the character and the plot. So what I always recommend to people, first of all, if you're going to look for meaning in this film, you will miss what the whole film is about. So like a traveler, a good traveler, just go on a journey and let your eyes be open to the sights that are coming to you. This is a non-mental exercise aimed at your solar plexus rather than your cerebellum.
To try to give listeners a sense of what they will encounter when they come in to see the film. Unlike Konjana Skazi, there are actors, or at least people who know you're filming them. There is this one amazing sequence, many minutes long, from the perspective, I guess, of television being watched by a crowd of people, and we see their intense reactions to something, but we're not sure. Is it, what is this? Is it a big game they're watching, maybe?
Well, there are three different kinds of viewing of screens in the film. All the people that are in the film are not acting. The direction was to achieve non-self-conscious behavior. They all knew they were being filmed. The little kids were watching movies. The older people were playing games. And the group were watching the Final Four basketball.
Uh-huh.
They all know that they're being filmed, but it was being filmed through a two-way mirror, so out of sight, out of mind. But more than that, when these electronic mediums come on, they're like tractor beams. We almost can't help ourselves.
We recently, especially, we've seen other nonfiction films that are not at all conventional documentaries, more poetic and less journalistic. The Act of Killing last year.
Oh, beautiful film. Powerful.
Absolutely amazing film. Are you aware of having had an influence on younger filmmakers in that sense of being you're free to make less journalistic documentaries?
I know because of testimonials to me personally and then through the net and all of that, that a lot of people have been affected by the films. Whether that means other people are going to do this form, I don't know. One would have to be committed to these, not with grace and gratuity, but like to an insane asylum to be able to pull this off.
Yeah.
So I'm not offering them for emulation, but I hope that they do touch some people.
Going back to the beginning of your career, I am – your background is amazing to me. You were in the Christian Brothers Order and, as one is, you assumed for life. How did you end up there and why did you leave?
Well, like most adolescents, I'm sure your audience will know this, adolescents form who they are by looking at the adults that they admire. When I was 13 years old, I was taught by Christian Brothers. Well, when I was 12 and 13, I'm from New Orleans. It's like a society that I love, but it's La Dolce Vita. It's like a crazy, crazy place. I was burning it on all ends, and I met these
as a little kid.
As a little kid. I mean, I'm from New Orleans. Give me a break. That's what it's about there. So I met these brothers who had an innate sense of joy, who were generous, who were happy, who were giving, who were not thinking of themselves. And I said, gee whiz, that's amazing. I'd like to be like them. Now, like most of us, we do the right thing for the wrong reason. I had no idea what I was getting into. I decided to leave home at 13. I actually left home at 14, never came back. I was a brother, a monk for
So instead of running away to join the circus.
I ran away to the Middle Ages, little did I know, and it made the Marine Corps look like the Boy Scouts. So it was a very intense but something that I am so thankful that I had the opportunity to experience. Anything that I'm doing now, I owe to the Christian Brothers.
And so you're 11 or 12 and getting into trouble or burning it at both ends. What does that mean in 1951 in New Orleans? What kind of trouble?
Oh, well, I don't know if I can say all of this. Girls, 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 drink. All the stuff I can't talk about, you know.
There's a movie in that. Not your kind of movie, but some kind of movie.
Well, you just have to, you know, it's kind of a fast town. It's called Sin City, and I love it very much. And if I forget it, it remembers me.
And then a decade or so later, you start deciding you're going to be a filmmaker. How did that choice come?
I was working. I was still a brother. I was working with street gangs. And during the course of that time, I had, as brothers, you don't see movies and stuff, or we didn't at that time. It was a much different period, like 1,000 years ago in the 50s and 60s. But I did see this film that a friend rented and brought to me called Los Olvidados by Luis Buñuel, which means The Young and the Damned, The Forgotten Ones. It was not entertaining. It was in black and white. It was surreal. And it was about juvenile delinquents in the barrios of Mexico City. When I saw that film, it was like a spiritual experience. So I bought a 16-millimeter copy and played it on the walls, on adobe walls and street corners all over Northern Mexico.
Another great scene in your biopic. In the 40 years since you started to make these Scotsy movies, which Crayon Scotsy, as we said, means life out of balance, do you feel that we've gotten any closer in any respect to life being in balance?
No, I don't. I feel that we're on a treadmill. We're at a period of great acceleration. We're all pursuing our technological happiness without realizing that the price we pay for that is the plummeting of our humanity and the planet that we live on.
And with that definitively pessimistic view, what keeps you going?
Well, I'm not pessimistic.
Really?
No, I'm not. My own proclivities are very upbeat, actually.
It seems like it.
And I'm very happy to be alive for now, above ground.
Even if civilization itself is
well, I mean, it's only a point of view. It's only a point of view. But I can't help feeling what I feel. And I feel we live in perhaps the most tragic period of mankind's presence on this planet. So I think it's unspeakable, unsayable what's happening right now. As it appears that we're in some kind of great acceleration of beauty, I think the price we're going to pay for that is unbelievable.
And yet, your film depictions of that unspeakable crash of species and civilization are also beautiful.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Art is to provoke. It gives us an access to a truth. I wanted to show the beauty of the beast, not the obviousness of injustice. I wanted to show something that we prize, our very glory. That's what I wanted to look at, that which is not looked at, ordinary daily living. That's the biggest tragedy on the planet, and that's the price we pay for the pursuit of our technological.
I would very much enjoy going on for a couple of hours with you, but you
Let's
haven't
go.
The time. Godfrey Reggio, I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it being here.
Godfrey Reggio is the director of Visitors, which has just opened. You can see some gorgeous images from the film and find out where it's playing at studio360.org. That's just about it for this hour of Studio 360. But before we go, one more movie story. This one from a listener in Lake Placid, New York, who wrote to us about a film that brought her to a pretty momentous decision in her life. Sarah Longley was born in Great Britain. She moved to America when she was 13, on her own, without her family. She married young and unhappily.
I believe I was 23 when I met my husband. I had been in a relationship that had ended kind of abruptly just a few months before I met my husband. And I think, in retrospect, it was probably a rebound. But I fell in love with his family. They sort of represented everything that I thought a family should be and everything that I hadn't ever had. I think I knew before my first child was born that we probably had made a mistake. I don't think either of us had really married for the right reasons, but I think we both tried to stick it through and be the better people rather than just sort of bailing. Shirley Valentine's a British film that stars Pauline Collins and Tom Conti and Joanna Lumley. I don't think it got much play in the States, but in Britain it was very popular. I'd seen the movie during the summertime when my sister was visiting me from England, and she said, oh, let's go get a movie. We went to the video store together, like you did back then, and she said, oh, you have to see this film. It's about a woman named Shirley who has all kinds of dreams and hopes and aspirations, and she gets married, and for a while things are really great. But the children grow up, and they've left home, and now it's just Shirley and her husband.
What happened to Shirley Valentine? She got married to a boy called Joe. And even though her name was changed to Bradshaw, she was still Shirley Valentine for a while. She knew who she was.
The dialogue is very much to the audience. She speaks directly to you, looks directly at you. And so you kind of become conspiratorial with Shirley.
But somewhere along the way, the boy called Joe turned into him. And Shirley Valentine turned into this.
And one of the things about Shirley was that she always wanted to travel, but her husband, Joe, didn't. But she has a friend who has won a holiday for two in Greece. And so she's thinking of how she can go on this trip without necessarily having to tell her husband that she's going.
Jesus, if I go to the bathroom for 5 minutes, he thinks I've been hijacked.
But then there's this strange game changer where they're very regimented with their meals. And on Thursday night, it's steak night. But she's been asked to take care of the dog across the street for the night and feed him his dinner. So Shirley takes out the steak that she'd bought for dinner and chops it up and gives it to the dog.
You wait till you taste this nice dinner. I bet you've never tasted anything like this.
And so now Joe has no steak for dinner.
We have steak on Thursday. We always have steak on Thursday.
Well, all right, it's Thursday, but we're having chips and egg for a change. You like chips and egg?
On a Tuesday.
I remember my heart beating wildly.
I'm working from morning till night, working me tripe out. And what do I find? You talking to the wall.
You know, since I was always walking on eggshells myself and never knowing what I was going to say or do that was going to set things off.
And I'm expected to eat this. Well, I'm not eating this. I'm not eating
This was such a turning point for her because she just realized the stupidity of the life that she was living with Joe. She stands up and she wipes her eggy hand across the poster that's hanging on the inside of a closet door.
What's that?
It's a place. It's a place I'm going to.
She announces that she's going to Greece. And I thought, wow, you're ballsy. I don't think that I would have been that ballsy at that time. She goes to this beautiful island and it's, you know, it's full of the little white houses and the crystal blue ocean and the blue, blue sky. And she stops in at a little taverna to have a drink and meets Kostas, who invites her to go on his brother's boat. And she ends up going skinny dipping with Kostas and they end up making love.
Oh, my God! Where did that orchestra come from?
Her eyes pop open. She says,
"You kiss me stretch marks.
Kiss my stretch marks." And I just love that scene. Any woman with stretch marks knows how self-conscious we are of those. And he says to her, "Don't ever be ashamed of these. These shows that you've lived. These shows that you've given life." And then she says, "Aren't men full of shit?" And I just love that. The film, to me, is a comedy in so many ways. She is so candid with her phrasing, and most of the time nobody else gets it, which is just so funny and relatable. The movie put the thought in my head, really, that I could have a different life. And so, you know, when I would be afraid and uncertain about things, I would think about Shirley, and within a year, I had decided that I was indeed going to leave my husband. When I divorced my husband, I really had no plan. And that was at a time when women were getting into the culinary field. So I applied to the CIA.
The Culinary Institute of America has truly changed the way the world looks at food.
Going to school, it was a difficult choice to make because it meant a great deal more hardship for my children. They were very young and they needed me a whole lot more than I ever really imagined they would. But I also felt that they needed a good role model and they needed somebody who stood up and did the right thing and was brave, and I needed to be that person for them and not the frightened woman that I had been.
I used to be the mother. I used to be the wife. But now I'm Shirley Valentine again.
Sarah Longley listens to the show on North Country Public Radio and teaches culinary arts at Paul Smith's College in the Adirondacks. Our story was produced by Sharon Mashihi. Has some work of art ever changed the course of your life? A movie, a book, a song, a painting, a dance performance, whatever? If so, we'd like to hear about it. Leave us a comment at studio360.org, and we might use your story on the show, too. And that's it for this hour of Studio 360. But don't forget, we really want you to make a really scary, really short film of no more than 30 seconds and send it to us for our contest.
Wes Craven presents Studio 360's Scary Short Film Fest.
And remember, the theme, which we're defining very broadly, is young genius. The writer-director Wes Craven will pick his favorites in a few weeks. All the details are at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Rose Connolly,
Eliza Martin,
Andres O'Hara Plotnick.
Thanks as ever to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Art Works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Nana Cherry has had some giant pop hits, but she always makes music her way.
I can't be like anyone else, and maybe that's the cool thing about being nearly 50. I'm finally, like, accepting that, you know, this is it.
I got a man, I love him so much, sometimes I hate it.
Nana Cherry is my guest next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.